We pick up midway between Luisa Martinez's two-part interview with immigration lawyer Daniel Kanstrom.
So you mentioned four pillars, I'm not quite sure, but you mentioned understanding deportation and immigration laws around race, gender, ideology, and poverty. And so sticking to the U.S., could you kind of give examples? I guess we've talked extensively about race, but like about gender, at least gender and poverty?
Gender is a little more complicated and it involves certain exclusion laws. But just as an example, I think you mentioned the Page Act and some of the laws of that period that tended to construct Chinese women as being, as they said at the time, you know, prostitutes or women who are coming here for immoral purposes. There's also the factor that most women for many, many decades in this country until fairly recently in our history, their citizenship was derivative of their husbands and they could lose it as a result of that and they could be exploited. Also, many fewer women had the means to travel than did men. So there's always been a gendered dimension to this. The numbers are not usually as large if you tabulate women who are deported as opposed to men, but that's more because fewer women have moved. And that's because also more of the women have tended to stay home with the children in the countries from which migrants come, and the men come here to make work. And then the families get torn apart by this. The men may find other women. The men may then get deported. So the effect of deportation on women is often both in this country if they get deported and also in the country from which their partners may have come in order to, you know, make money to send back home. This system of border controls puts enormous pressure on families. And it's extremely difficult to keep a family together if one of them is working in this country for years and the other is back home with the children. Particularly, the deportation system tends to lock people in. So whereas we had many generations of Mexican, again, it was mostly Mexican men, crossing the border back and forth so they could be with their families, once you have a deportation system in place, let alone a wall or, you know, the kind of militarization that you're seeing, now suddenly it's a much higher stakes thing to be able to get to this country, and you have to stay for as long as you possibly can to make as much money as you possibly can, because each crossing becomes that much more difficult. I mean, certainly there have been women who have been deported as well. Around the world, you see more of a gendered aspect of this, particularly in countries like in the Middle East, where you have domestic workers who are sent by the Philippines, for example, and who live in extremely precarious situations where they have very few rights. They can be easily abused. And even if they get pregnant, it's considered a breach of their contract and they can be deported for that. That has not been a major component in the United States, although there's been some of that. And there have also been many concerns over many years raised about women who are in abusive relationships, non-citizen women who have been exploited by U.S. citizen partners, but who have been unable to raise that claim because they were then fearing that they would get deported if they came to the attention of the authorities. This was in large part why the Violence Against Women Act was passed, in order to create some pathways for women in those kind of situations where they would have their own right to stay, you know, to get a visa if they could show that they had been abused or battered or, you know, something like that.
Perhaps maybe 20 years ago, in the social imagination of the United States, immigration was represented basically by a single man, what you were saying before, a young single man. Now it's less about single men, young single men, and more families, right? And so the narrative starts to shift a little bit in terms of the social debate from they're taking our jobs to now they're taking our resources.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's been particularly true among certain groups, like the people coming up from Guatemala and much of the migration from Mexico. It's still less true among like Africans or those who have to make longer journeys to get here. But many of those, maybe most of those, I would say, are refugees with asylum claims who are more fleeing, you know, political persecution. But you're right about that. And that is true that the current narrative is much about public schools and emergency rooms. Of course, this was true in the past. I mean, the major Supreme Court case about whether the undocumented children of undocumented people have a right to a public school education was decided in 1982. And I'm very worried about that precedent, because that was a 5-4 decision even then. And that was during when there were many more liberal justices on the court. So these issues are not entirely new. I think family migration has caused a lot of disturbing examples of, you know, children being separated from their mothers. Of course, that's been a horrific example during the last Trump administration, but families being locked up altogether was not a good thing either. And that happened on a very large scale during the Obama administration. So the movement of families together creates enormous difficulties. And there does tend to be resistance when large numbers of migrants enter the public school system or the hospitals and so forth. It was somewhat foreseeable that what is happening now in New York, the sort of reactionary politics that develop when the mayor of New York, you know, said this will bankrupt the city of New York if we don't get funding. I mean, these states that had shelter laws that activists had worked very hard to create for unhoused people. And, you know, I thought those were really progressive laws. But then there is a point where they do become overwhelmed. And so unless you have some federal support, it does create backlash. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now. And my guess is that the Trump administration, once they start asking everybody on buses and trains to show papers, is going to provoke the opposite sort of backlash when people realize that it's not a clear us and them, that we U.S. citizens tend to be married to many of them, and we know many, like we're all sort of in this together. And if the government starts enforcing these laws through school raids and church raids and hospital raids and asking everybody to show their papers everywhere, you know, you're going to see a backlash of a different type. Now, people on the left, a certain strand of people on the left, have made very strong arguments against borders entirely. So this is where the debate has tended to be in the circles that I travel in. That debate strikes me at the moment as a little bit anachronistic, because I think we're not at a point where we can really have that discussion.
You don't believe in open borders, or at least don't think that that's a realistic demand. So could you talk about, your position on that?
Not only do I not think it's a realistic demand, and it is clearly not a realistic demand. There is no history of this being accepted, except in very constrained, very limited, very unique circumstances, for example, Europe, or certain experiments among relatively small numbers of countries in South America. But in the places where it would be the most needed, it sparks the greatest resistance. And I think it could lead to actual, some really bad consequences. I think, for example, about what is my position on the border policies of Ukraine or on the border policies of Tibet. Borders represent a conflict between two extremely powerful, extremely fundamental human attributes. One is the human need to move. I think we have always been creatures of movement. That's part of our story. And it's a survival skill. To be human is to be capable of thinking about moving. And this applies whether you're from Chile coming to the US or from the US thinking about Mars. I mean, I think it's just part of humanity is the need to move. But the other part of humanity, which I think is equally important, is the need to form communities and to have communities that are stable over time, so that I want my children, I want to have some sense of what the world is going to be for my children. And for that reason, I want to create something in the nature of as stable a community as I possibly can for them. If you agree with that, then the question becomes, what sorts of boundaries should communities have? And this is a question of the nature of characteristics. So you could base a community on race, or you could base it on religion. And I don't like those things. I think a community could be based most legitimately on shared values, on, you know, a certain shared cultural history, certain agreements like a constitution. And the second question is, what is the appropriate size of a community? What's the right level? So having thought about this for many years, I very much respect the position of the people who critique the border. I think the border can often be, and almost always has been, an instrument of a certain form of oppression. But it has also been a protective mechanism for communities. And I think the task is to, first of all, ask, is the nation state a reasonable form of human organization to mediate these things? And if not, what's better? Now, some people say maybe the city is the better form, you know, maybe being more local. That gives greater voice to the people. It allows more experiments, more fluidity of cultural development and so forth. I'm willing to have that discussion. And there have been city-states historically that have been very important, Rome, for example. But for me, the question is not, should the nation state exist or should the border exist, but what power should the government have to enforce those borders, and what limits should be set on that power? And this is where I think human rights and international law and certain fundamental ideas of freedom of movement become really important. And that's why I think the UN system was right to build in not only sovereignty, but human rights into the very creation of the United Nations system in the post-war period. I realize this might seem kind of quaint and anachronistic, but I do think that if you eliminated borders, people would recreate community, probably on grounds that we would find even less appealing than the civic form of the nation state. And so I like to devote my efforts to fighting for the rights of people on the move when they encounter government power. And I think that's a really important venue for rights, because the victories that you get at that point also tend to resonate in positive ways into the society. In immigration studies and in sovereignty studies and in deportation defense work, the individual at the absolute lowest moment of her power and status and life chances encounters the nation state in all of its glory, in its absolute strongest form. And so the question is, what can the individual say at that moment? What can the individual do? So I also look at activism across borders, how people develop solidarity across borders. But I'm saying that I think that's a place where we don't have to abolish the border in order to render it much, much more humane and much, much more amenable to other types of legal constraints, which I think would be positive. International coordination among providers of social services and education and all that, that's important, because it can bring a measure of activism across the border in positive ways and protect people. And I think rights generically, you know, as a legal construct, have this feature that they're not limited to one particular nation state. So operating within a rights framework is consonant with trying to transcend the border. And it doesn't necessarily require a theory of the ultimate elimination of the border.
I did want to get your perspective as an immigration law scholar, professor. In what ways, if any, do you believe that the current administration deviates from a Democratic president like Obama and his administration when it comes to immigration, materially, the impacts, not the rhetoric, right? How do you understand the differences?
The differences in practice are quite profound. I mean, Obama was criticized for ramping up certain types of deportations, for putting in place a program that they called, for example, Felons Not Families, which I did not support. I thought they spent a lot of time trying to differentiate the sort of good migrants from the bad migrants and justify certain types of deportation. On the other hand, in terms of the way that some of these systems were implemented, they were supporting DACA, they were supporting DAPA, they did have refugee admissions, they were allowing people to apply for asylum. These are not small things. I've spent much of my life criticizing the immigration and deportation policies of Democratic administration. But if you're asking, is there a difference between, for example, what the George W. Bush administration did after 9/11, calling in young Muslim American men for mandatory registration and interviews, or what the Trump administration is proposing now? eliminating the 14th Amendment right of birthright citizenship and implementing a carry your papers regime for everybody and threatening criminal prosecution for people who have been in this country for decades. Yeah, I think there's a big difference there. Much of the history of immigration law in this country has been a struggle between actors like the current Trump administration who want to see a regime of power and expeditious deportation of the maximum number of people and the creation of the maximum amount of fear. I mean, they say it, they want people to be scared and they think that they'll voluntarily self-deport because of that. And of course, precarity, which is a formula for exploitation, versus people who have said, no, we have to welcome people, we have to treat people with dignity and respect, and we have to put into place legal protections for people. So the reason a lot of people in this country are not subject to expedited removal, although millions are, is because of victories that took place in the legal system using the language of due process and trying to build little by little rights into some of these statutes and into a court system that said, for example, as I've said in my own work, if you're deporting a person, that's really not different from prosecuting them for crime, and that person should have similar rights to a criminal defendant. Like, why do we give anybody rights? There are two reasons, generically speaking. One is because you want to respect the dignity of the individual, but the other is because you want to restrain the power of a government from excessive arbitrariness and excessive cruelty. So I think that's the struggle now, and we happen to be in a moment where the government is going to be in need of some restraint, and that's why we have laws, and that's why we have courts, but also that's where activism and organizing in cooperation with laws comes into place. Now, a lot of lawyers find themselves in a very difficult position right now. I was just asked yesterday, you know, would I advise a client not to comply with the mandatory registration laws? As a lawyer, you actually cannot ethically advise a client to violate the law. But what I can say to a client is, this is a really hard decision, and I want to have enough respect so that I can give you enough information so that you can make the decision on your own. There are going to be consequences either way, and I can't tell you what to do.
So what would you say, given the conditions, given a right-wing majority in Congress, given a right-wing majority in Supreme Court, what do you do in that case, where it seems like the deck is stacked against one in all the branches?
Well, again, as one who tries to take the long view on these things, I remember being asked by DACA eligible people 13 years ago whether I thought they should apply for DACA. And I remember saying to them exactly what I just said to you, which is, this is a really hard decision. And I don't think you should think it's an easy decision, because once you put yourself into a government database, once you reveal yourself, you're giving up one of the most powerful protections people in precarious situations have, which is anonymity. And I think a person should think long and hard about that. Governments change. I mean, the history of this country has been a history of very strenuous enforcement and massive deportation. That's why I wrote the book. Deportation has been integral to the United States from the very beginning. This is a down period. This is a very hard period. But, you know, there were aspects of the Roosevelt administration that were like this. There were aspects of the Eisenhower administration in which we saw massive deportations of millions of people back to Mexico. So in some ways, it's not unique. It is particularly harsh right now and particularly cruel. But there are limits. I mean, there's a question of how they're going to get the resources to deport anywhere near the number of people that they're talking about. Again, as I said, you can create a show me your papers law, but once they start asking U.S. citizens to show papers, particularly U.S. citizens of color, which is probably the more likely thing that's going to start happening, you're going to start seeing resistance. You know, if they actually start raiding schools and churches, you're going to see massive resistance to that. I mean, even Kristi Noem, I think, was facing pushback in South Dakota, where people were saying, if you start deporting all the non-citizen, the undocumented workers from the meatpacking plants, we're going to drown in our cows. it's very hard to unravel this entire system over the course of one administration. I think it's a question of staying calm and carrying on and picking your battles.
Well, I did want to ask about your understanding of how U.S.-backed illegal sanctions against countries, particularly in Latin America, but you're welcome to talk about the Global South, the relationship to immigration and deportation in this country.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting feature of this administration, although, again, not entirely historically unique, but using economic pressure and things like tariffs to compel governments to transform their own migration policies or their own reception policies to fit more what the U.S. wants. You know, there's certainly a long history of that kind of thing. My guess is that usually, historically, bullying promotes a certain facile veneer of acquiescence, but not actual cooperation. And I think, for example, the government of Mexico is going to do things that, you know, move some troops to the border, take some people back, pick up enforcement, but they're going to pursue the policy that they think is best for Mexico in the long run. There's a lot of bullying that's going on now, threatening to take back the Panama Canal or to make Canada the 51st state. To me, this is not serious policy, and I think it'll wear thin quickly, and you'll start seeing pushback and reaction, which may be overt or may be covert, by a lot of the countries in Latin America, in particular, that have, you know, their own histories and their own governments and their own concerns. They're not that easy to manipulate or push around on a large scale. You know, Panama has one hotel where they can take a certain number of people, but we're talking about 11 million or more. There may be, you know, somewhere between 11 and 20 million undocumented people in this country. I don't see how you're going to have the wherewithal, A, to implement that sort of a program in this country, given budgetary constraints and legal constraints. So you'd have to really create a police state, because there's no way to differentiate the citizen from the non-citizen just by looking at them. And then the question is, who's going to take them back? Like, where are they going to go? That destabilizes the countries that you're deporting people to, which then creates new flows of ever more desperate migrants. I mean, people don't usually leave their homes unless they have a very powerful reason for doing it. And if you start undercutting the economies of the other countries in the hemisphere, you're just recapitulating the same dynamic that created this situation in the first place. But I agree with you about the ideology of the American dream, you know, but it is somewhat interesting to say, if you want to understand the migration and deportation policies of the Trump administration, read the poem at the base of the Statue of Liberty and then just presume the exact opposite. So, you know, it says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It's the opposite. If you're tired, you can't work, we don't want you. If you're poor, we certainly don't want you. We want golden visas. If you're yearning to breathe free, you're a socialist or an anarchist or a communist, and we certainly don't want you. You know, but that's been true of the United States for decades. Yeah, let me say one last thing. You asked about the difference between refugees and migrants, and this is an important thing, because there has been a history of humanitarian protections for people who are fearing at least certain kinds of persecution. And of course, one can be critical of the boundaries of the refugee laws. They only protect political refugees, not economic refugees. That's all an important discussion to have. But shutting off the door, closing the door to refugees and asylum seekers is really, really a feature of this administration that I think is abominable and really cruel. And, you know, I've known so many people over the course of my life as a lawyer who have genuine asylum claims, and they need to be protected. And it's just terrible to see that system being rejected and diminished.
Okay, well, obviously, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You loved your people in the face of the American dream. Fry bread and tortillas, some wars are the same. Who thinks Wounded Knee and Sand Creek happen only in history books? Is this not history? We live and die. But this isn't El Salvador.